Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kenneth Citrin from Klein Cote Edward Citrin LLC in Aspen, Colorado. My bar number is 43083. And I would like to ask the court if I may reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're here today to determine whether a preliminary injunction entered by the trial court that enjoins my client, Colleen Gross, from exercising powers under a not-for-profit association that she formed on behalf of a common interest community of which she and the appellees are the sole members. We are fully in agreement with all of the findings of fact of the court below. We have no dispute at all with anything there, and therefore we would suggest that the standard of review in this court is de novo pursuant to Evans v. Romer. We would like to focus our attention on the issue of the RAFCA issue of likelihood of success on appeal, and likelihood of success on the merits, I should say. We contend that the appellees do not have a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits, specifically on the issue of whether they gave their consent to the formation of the not-for-profit association. The court below found that, and I quote, that while the Dijons were on notice that they were to be members of an association, this does not mean they were obligated to become members of a homeowners association that did not exist at the time of their purpose. We disagree with that finding as a matter of law. In fact, the court below found that it focused its attention not on the question of consent, but the question of the formalities that our client pursued in forming the association. We believe that consent is, as a matter of law, imposed upon the Dijons. We're arguing that they are not liable to become members because they never gave their consent.
Seems to me that where the issue is distilled down to is the delay between the developer and the subsequent purchasers and the silence in the statute addressing it one way or the other. Can you help us with that? The statute's silent on that point?
Well, in fact, Your Honor, the statute's not even completely silent on it, and I'm sure that my adversary will argue, and I might as well address it right up front. Section 301 of Kiowa does state that a association is to be formed prior to the first sale. That did not happen here, conceitedly. However, our belief is that that section of the statute is intended to protect purchasers from developers who may engage in oppressive conduct upon selling off units. And that once the developer is out of the picture, as the developer was here, that statute isn't specifically relevant. I would like to direct the court's attention specifically to the case of Hailan Homeowners Association v. Knotts. We cited in our brief, it is 215 P. 3rd, 1271. It's a case from this court in 2009. It is therefore a post-Kyle case. In the Hailan case, the declaration was recorded in 1963 and expressly said there has been organized a not-for-profit corporation known as the Hailan Homeowners Association, of which membership is mandatory. In fact, that was not the case. The association wasn't formed, and wasn't formed until 1987, many years later than the declaration was recorded. The court in Hailan, on a similar challenge as the court is facing here, found expressly that the language, the past tense language, although regarding the formation, demonstrates that the original covenants anticipated the formation of an association. This finding by the court is very similar to the findings of the trial court in our case, where the court found, and again I quote, the amended covenants contemplated that LVTC would be governed by a nonprofit corporation operating as a homeowners association to be known as Lakeview Town Home condominiums, homeowners association. The reason we bring this case up is that the court in Hywan was unconcerned with the use of different tenses, that the homeowners association had been formed, although it had not, and did not preclude the later formation after the developer was out of the picture. This decision against the homeowner directly contradicts the appellee's argument that because there was no express provision for, regarding formation in the declaration in our case, it is ambiguous. Hywan doesn't distinguish between the past use of the past tense and the later formation. That is the Colorado case that is most directly on point. However, in our brief, we also cited to a number of out-of-state cases that address very similar issues as we are facing here today. The first is Griffin versus Tall Timbers Development, 681 South 2nd 546. That's a 1996 case from Mississippi, which also addresses the question of late formation of a homeowners association and question of whether the homeowners consented to the formation. The facts in that case is that in 1980, a corporation called the Talmar Corporation purchased the project from the original developer and turned around and sold it again in 1985 to White Cypress Lakes Development. At the time of the case, it was owned by a third entity, Tall Timbers Development. Talmar, in 1980, or around 1980, recorded restrictions, covenants, and conditions that said that it shall have the right in its, meaning Talmar's, sole discretion to formulate, organize, and establish the property owners association. However, it never did form the association, and it was not until 1992, when Tall Timbers owned the development, that it formed an association and enacted bylaws. In that case, the plaintiff contended that the right to create a mandatory property owners association was personal to Talmar per the reservation of rights in the declaration, and that it did not run with the land, and that once Talmar conveyed the property, the right to create the HOA expired. The court in that case identified the issue as whether a homeowners association can be formed at all if the first developer never created one. In other words, whether the capacity to form a homeowners association is a covenant that runs with the land or if it is personal to the original developer. And the court held that the right to form the HOA does in fact run with the land and binds subsequent assignees and successors of the original developer. It's very similar to the holding in the Colorado case, Chateau Condominiums versus Daniels, 754 P3rd 425, again a case from this court in 1988, where the court expressly found that the declaration is a covenant running with the land. In fact, this is a rule that was recognized by the trial court at the preliminary injunction stage. And the Chateau Condominiums Court went on to state that owners are on constructive notice of the provisions of the declaration, and because of that, an owner cannot claim that there was no consent to the formation. In that case, from this court, the decision went against the homeowners challenging the formation as well. Getting back to the Griffin case, the Tall Timbers case, the holding was, and I understand this is an out of jurisdiction case, but we suggested it is a precedent that this court may take note of and receive guidance from, said that again, the lot owners were on notice that they would have to become members of the property association, and that they had sufficient notice to anticipate that the association would be formed and they would be bound. Another out-of-state case that we believe is persuasive is Willow Lake Residential Association versus Giuliano. This is an Alabama Court of Appeals case, 80 South 3rd 226 from 2010, again addressing the question of consent. And I will note with respect to this case that Alabama, as Colorado has adopted the Uniform Act regarding common interest communities. The facts in that case are that in 1995, a declaration was filed which contemplated the formation of a nonprofit corporation as operating an HOA. That language that it contemplated is the identical language used by the trial court in this case in discussing the declaration, so we think that this is a persuasive case. But notwithstanding the 1995 declaration, the HOA was not formed until August 2006. The HOA was sued under similar grounds as here, that they had no authority to form. And the court in that case held that each homeowner consented to become members of the nonprofit corporation. In fact, the court in our case found that the appellees gave their consent and was focusing simply on the question of whether they had an opportunity to participate in the formation, which we think is immaterial once the consent is given by virtue of their purchase of their unit and their membership in the common interest community under the declaration.
So, counsel, you have 4 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that I will not be able to reserve as much time as I'd like, but I'd like to address some of the other RAFCE factors briefly. The first is whether there's immediate irreparable harm in this case. We believe the answer is no, that any harm alleged is not irreparable, since any improper actions by the HOA can be remedied per the not-for-profit statute and common law by an action for damages by the appellees against the appellant. And we also believe that with respect to the issue of protection of the public, the issue of K9 Shrink LLC versus Ridgewood Meadows, 278 P3rd, 372, a 2011 case from the Colorado Court of Appeals, states that the Kiowa is intended to protect the interests of the state and its citizens, even if individual homeowners object and may suffer economic or other detriment. We think that given that public policy of Kiowa, that the protection of the public actually mitigates in favor of having the association here, not against it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Christopher D. Bryan, Garfield and Hatch Law Firm, 601 East Hyman, Aspen, Colorado, Attorney Registration Number 35522. I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiffs and appellees, Caroline and Felix Dejean. They found out months after Ms. Gross organized, incorporated a HOA without their consent, and then held a meeting, enacted bylaws, elected herself as the agent for the HOA, that she was going to bind the Dejeans in various ways. She would have the power, if the HOA was deemed to be valid and effective, into contracts with third parties, the ability to lien property owned by the Dejeans, the ability to make representations for which...
Can I interrupt you? Why do you say they did not have notice?
Because they were not given the ability to... Well, first of all, they weren't getting actual notice in the beginning of that Ms. Gross was going to do that. She did it unilaterally. They only learned about it after the fact. So there was an actual notice issue with what she did, with the way she organized this HOA in March of 2013.
How about the language of the declaration?
Well, the language of the declaration is interesting. You're right. It does contemplate an association, but the association was not in existence at the time that Section 301 of Kiowa required it to be, nor was it in existence when Ms. Gross took title in the early 1990s, I believe, nor was it in existence in 1995 when my clients took title. So during that time period, there was no association. You're right. The declaration that was drafted, apparently a copy and paste or cookie cutter declaration, contemplated the existence of it, but the declarant, Teresa Schiff, or Terry Schiff, chose not to, For whatever reason, we haven't gotten to that because we haven't had discovery. Remember, we're only here on preliminary injunction appeal. We haven't had disclosures, discovery, any of the things that we might learn more of the facts about. But the court, the lower court, felt that it was sufficiently important to say, hold on, there might be more issues here. The safest course of action at this early stage of the litigation is to enjoin the HOA, which hasn't existed for the better part of 2 decades since the declaration was enacted, and let the status quo remain. And everything worked fine between these duplex owners during that period where there was no association. And look what's happened in the 18 months since the preliminary injunction hearing. The sky hasn't fallen. There have been no problems. Both sets of clients are continuing to work on common ownership or common element maintenance issues as necessary. So it goes to the point that what Ms. Gross was trying to do with this misperceived sense of urgency to create an association really wasn't necessary. It wasn't done in the proper way.
May I interrupt you for a moment? So as I understand your position, you're not contesting that your clients had noticed that there would be an association. Your concern is the manner in which the association was formed?
That is one of the concerns, yes. And specifically, I would draw your attention to the lower court's ruling in which the Judge Petrie found that constructive consent to being in what the Dejeans could reasonably have assumed was an existing entity at the time they took title is not the same as giving Ms. Gross, and I'm quoting, a blank check to unilaterally incorporate the new entity, name herself as the initial registered agent, and draft and enact bylaws.
So what is the difference between the association then that Ms. Gross formed and what association it was your clients could have anticipated they would be a member of based upon the declaration?
Well, a couple of things there, Your Honor. First, the declaration contemplated an association created by the declarant. Now, Section 301 of Kiowa says that such an association must be created before the first sale. That didn't happen. So my clients became accustomed to the fact that there was no HOA. They relied on that for the better part of a decade and a half.
Yes, but that's a timing issue. Your counterpart stood up and gave us cases from other jurisdictions and suggested that their guidance for the proposition that the timing doesn't matter if it's in the declaration. Do you have contra authority for that?
Yes, Your Honor. I would draw your attention to Section 6.3 of the third restatement.
Now, have any courts signed off on that, 6.3, for the proposition that you want us to adopt?
Not particularly, Your Honor. Not in Colorado, not in the reported case law that we found. However, this court and the Colorado Supreme Court do look to the third restatement of property generally, and there's the Goodyear case that I cite for that proposition. Now, Kiowa doesn't provide recourse for a 301 violation like we have from Ms. Gross or an alternative, but the restatements do. And that says owners of a majority of the lots or units not owned by the developer may create an association to manage the common property and enforce the servitudes if it's not done by the time required by Section 301 or the declaration, going to your question, Judge Ashby. So that's important because that gives a mechanism. And that could have occurred here. We're not saying that there's no recourse. The recourse would be give the Dejeans proper notice. Have a meeting. Discuss this. Don't go do something unilaterally. Let me give you a hypo test of why the way that this occurred would create bad precedent. Suppose you have a larger HOA where there wasn't a declarant-created association in a timely manner in accordance with Section 301 or the terms of the declaration. What would happen if you have 50 homeowners, let's say? What if each of them, or several of them, went out and formed their own HOA, saying, well, I've got the authority under the declaration. Oh, I've got the constructive consent from each of these homeowners. Well, then you have people going to create things unilaterally, and you create a big problem with associations then. Now, you're not going to see that here because there's only two homeowners. But if you create the precedent that says that what Ms. Groves did is okay to unilaterally form an HOA based on constructive consent for a declaration that was not existing at the time title transferred, that is going to create a problem throughout the state for HOA creation, and you're not going to have a systematic and organized way for these associations to organize themselves. Mr. Citron cites the Bordelon case from Louisiana, but look what happened in that case. 94% of the homeowners agreed to form the HOA after the putative deadline, for, you know, under the declaration. That didn't happen here. You didn't have a majority. In the other cases that he cites, especially Allen and Griffin, the associations already existed before the challenger took title. And what the challengers there were doing, saying, well, that wasn't properly created before I came here, but it was in existence before they took title. That's a key factual distinction that's not present in this case. In this case, the two duplex owners became accustomed to working with one another without the formal organization of an HOA. Imagine the Dijon's surprise when they discovered that Ms. Gross, on her own one day, just incorporated.
So are you suggesting that because they operated without one, that that somehow created an expectation that there would never be one?
That was an argument that was advanced in the court below, and the court bracketed that, saying there would need to be further fact-finding for that purpose. And we agree with that, Your Honor. There might be a waiver argument or some sort of estoppel that could be formulated through the discovery of evidence, for example, deposing the declarant, who is still alive and I think was in Florida. None of those things happened. What we're here before you today on a very narrow issue is, did Judge Petrie adopt the most cautious attitude? And we say that he did. He said, I'm going to preserve the status quo pending the outcome of this litigation. The preliminary injunction is the most judicially conservative approach because it doesn't create uncertainty for anybody that might contract with the HOA. It puts a halt on Ms. Gross's activities until the litigation can be concluded.
But he needed to follow the Rathke factors and find that each one had been established in order to get to that cautious approach, right?
That's right, and he most certainly did. He paid particular attention to what's commonly referred to as the most important Rathke factor, which is likelihood of success on the merits. We've been discussing that mostly today. So with respect to the other factors, they weigh heavily in favor of the Dijons, including protecting the public interest so that third parties don't enter into a contract with an HOA that might later be found not to be in existence and therefore judgment-proof, for example.
And what about the second Rathke factor? Can't you, don't you have a monetary award that can adequately compensate your clients?
No, Your Honor, we don't have an adequate remedy at law. Money cannot compensate them for the impairment of their property rights. For example, what if the HOA decides, with Ms. Gross as the self-appointed registered agent and president, decides to lien under the super priority statute of Kiowa the property of the Dijons, or sends a bill that the Dijons don't honor or respect because they question the validity before court has entered final judgment as to the validity of the association, then they would lose their property rights, possibly. They would have liens that could be foreclosed upon under the super priority mechanism of I think it's section 316 of Kiowa, and they would be deprived of their statutory right. We haven't talked about this yet, but the Nonprofit Association Act in Title VII, they would be deprived of their statutory right not to be constricted into an association that they had no control over the formation of. And that's one of the other bases for the inadequate remedy of law. And the Dijons couldn't have exercised their rights to vote because they didn't even have notice that Ms. Gross was doing all these things until after it happened. Okay. And the judge did make sufficient findings of fact on that, Your Honor.
Don't they become members and directors once this association is formed?
They become, you mean in the association that Ms. Gross forms or
yes.
A general association?
Yes, this association that she formed.
Yes, because there's only two homeowners, de facto, yes, they would be, I suppose, officers. And then there'd be a question of, you know, if two people on 50% voting rights in a HOA have a deadlock. But the declaration foresees that problem and creates a tie-break mechanism.
Right.
In section 31 of the declaration. That's what Ms. Rose should have utilized. Instead of going to the Secretary of State and reporting this, she should have said, she should have given notice that she wants to start the HOA, even though it's years after the fact, after the 301 violation. And then if the Dijon still refused to participate in that formation meeting or that discussion, then she could utilize Section 31 of the declaration. That's the proper way to go about this. But for someone to unilaterally go form things is only going to create havoc with our homeowners associations throughout the state, and when there are disagreements and disputes like this. We need to follow, to the best extent possible, the language of the operative documents and read those in harmony with Kiowa. And when it is silent on the statute, we should look at the Uniform Act on which it's based, which we cite to in our response brief, our answer brief, and to the restatement. Section 6.3 is helpful in that regard. I know that's a long answer to your question, I apologize.
So your rule basically would state that if the association is not immediately formed, then it can never be formed without the consent of all the other owners in the condominium?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't draw that sharp of a line. I would say that we should look to two different things to answer that question. One, is there a majority, 50% plus one, of owners who want to form it after the fact? Because that would be consistent with Section 6.3 of the Third Restatement of Property Servitudes. Two, you would look elsewhere to the declaration for other mechanisms that it provides for resolving these issues. Section 31 does that with the tie-breaking mechanism. Ms. Gross ignored that and decided to take matters into her own hands and go record and set up an organization. So no, I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. I'm not saying that if you don't do it by the deadline, then it can never be done, because we do know that there are times that happens and there must be ways around that. That's not what I'm advocating for. I'm advocating that we follow the restatement, Kiowa, and the declaration to the best extent possible under these unique factual circumstances. And I would also I would want the court below to allow discovery to unfold in its proper course before lifting the injunction. That's all we're here for right now. Unless there are any other questions, I'll rest on my oral argument and the brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
In the short time I have left, I'd like to address some of the points raised by Mr. Bryan. First, with respect to the applicability of Section 6.3 of the Restatement, we think that it is misapplied by the appellees. Subsection 1 of that section states that if a creation of an association has not otherwise been provided for and has not been expressly excluded by the declaration, then the majority rule. In this case, it has been provided for in the declaration. It states that this particular not-for-profit with a specific name would be formed. So we think that section of the restatement is inapplicable. Judge Ashby, with respect to your question of counsel on waiver, there is a no waiver provision in the declaration, so we don't think there could be a waiver based on past conduct of acting without an association. We think that is inaccurate. With respect to the issue of the tie-break provision, the judge in the court below expressly found that every time my client tried to exercise that tie-break provision, it was, in the words of the court, rejected by the Dijons. So I think the suggestion to resort to the tie-break provision would have been a better way to go than to form the association is inaccurate. It would have been futile. Next, with respect to Ms. Dijon's appointing herself as agent for service, I think we all know that gives her no powers or rights with respect to the conduct of the association. And in fact, there have not been officers or directors elected to this association because of the initiation of this lawsuit. So she has no greater rights or powers than Dijon's would be able to have or are given. under the declaration, the not-for-profit law, and the bylaws. And finally, with respect to the issue that the Dijons did not have notice of what Ms. Gross was doing, we concede that they did not have advance notice of the formation of the association, but they were given advance notice in a draft of the bylaws before the bylaws were enacted on two separate occasions and neglected or refused to participate in the drafting or passage of those bylaws. So with respect to all of those five issues that were raised by my adversary, I would suggest that they have no applicability to the court's determination.
So counsel, I have one final question for
yes,
you.
Your Honor.
There are two homeowners here. This is not a 1,000-member HOA. So given that, what's the harm here of preserving the status quo until we get the outcome of a trial?
I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor, if you'd like
That's
me to answer
right.
your
Please
question.
Do.
There are two particular harms that my client has already encountered. My adversary said the sky hasn't fallen, perhaps not, but there are, have been some negative implications of not having an association. Number one, my client has found it difficult to obtain insurance on the common elements. And number two, she has found that without an association, she's been unable to refinance her half of the duplex because the association had never been formed.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. We'll now move